From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made during the Industrial Revolution. Worker cooperatives rose to prominence as workers began to organize. The cooperative model allowed employees to own the business for which they worked, and leaders in the early movement decried what they perceived as the evils of unbridled capitalism and the insecurities of wages. Worker-owned businesses can be found around the world. There's a particularly strong presence, for example, of co-ops in the Basque region of Spain. Time magazine writes that many people tend to think of co-ops, worker-owned businesses, and the various models as, quote, small-scale hippie enclaves. But Time writes that in Spain, that is the furthest from the truth that you can get. The Mondragon Corporation, for example, formed after the Spanish Civil War. It's been a rock of consistency, a large network, and in 2008, at the peak of the Spanish recession, Mondragon's income rose 6%. Wages rose, too, when all around the country wages were falling. The cooperatives have seen an ebb and flow in the UK. The city of Cleveland, Ohio, recently invested in the worker-owned model as a way of targeting impoverished neighborhoods. And now we could see the city of Rochester making a similar effort. What would that look like? How do worker-owned businesses function? What is their mission? What are the differences among the various, the worker-owned co-ops, retail co-ops, ESOPs? We're going to work through all of that this hour with our panel. On the line with us is Michael Healy of the CDS Consulting Co-op. Michael, thank you for taking the time.
Hey, you betcha.
Larry Filipski is here, the Chief Financial Officer for Once Again Nut Butter. Larry, thank you for being here.
You're welcome.
Jim DeLuca is the General Manager of Abundance Cooperative Market. Jim, thank you for being here.
You're welcome.
And we're going to find out what these various entities, how you all function, because you guys are slightly different, and that's fascinating to me. But Michael, I'm going to start with you. When you, because you work, as I understand it, you work with cooperative boards around the country, and when we just look broadly at this picture, whether it's an ESOP, a retail cooperative, a worker-owned business, what is the general mission of these kinds of enterprises?
Well, you know, mission is one thing. So any enterprise might have a different mission. The thing that is interesting or important about all these structures is they're models of ownership. And so it's really a matter of who owns the business. So cooperatives are businesses, and like any other business, you want to know who owns the business. So rather than being owned by an individual or through stock equity, these are businesses that are owned by groups of people in various forms. So ESOPs are one form of worker ownership. Cooperatives are another form of ownership, and they could be owned by workers, they could be owned by consumers, they could be owned by producers, or some combination of different constituencies. But it's less, you know, mission is a secondary thing within any of these businesses if they have a mission.
Okay, and Michael, when you look around the country economically, what percentage of our American economy, for example, is made up of enterprises like this, these models?
Well, I don't know if I can answer that. There's some information that I got from University of Wisconsin Center of Cooperatives, where they say that around the country, cooperatives have about $3 trillion in assets, that there are about 2 million people who work in cooperatives, that about a third of Americans are members of cooperatives, and that overall cooperatives have about $650 billion in sales, $150 billion in income. So this is not, cooperatives are not the major player in the economy, but a lot of people are owners of or workers in cooperatives.
Are they growing?
I would say yes, but again, there's cooperatives in all different sectors, right? So there are, the world that I work in mostly is the world of food cooperatives, and most of those are consumer-owned, and there is currently what is being described as a third wave of cooperative growth in that sector. So in other sectors, you know, there are agricultural cooperatives where farmers are owning distribution cooperatives together. I don't know that I can speak to whether those sectors are growing, but I think overall the cooperative sector is growing.
And Michael, before I kick it to our panel and studio here for their own perspectives, the reason I started with the question about mission is this. Again, you go back to that, the Industrial Revolution, when we saw more of a proliferation of worker-owned businesses, and so much, at least at the time, was focused on a lack of egalitarianism, an effort to, you know, create fairness and wage security, et cetera. And what I'm trying to make sure I understand is the Monard movement reflective of at least some of those desires, at least what you experience when you work around the country with various boards? Are these, the question of why do it this way, is the answer at least rooted in the idea of fairness, stability, et cetera?
I think that's certainly, you know, why else would anyone go through the effort that it takes to form a cooperative and do this unless there was some gap that the market economy was not filling, right? There was something that wasn't working just the way you would want it to work. And so oftentimes cooperatives, in essence, by definition, cooperatives are people who have joined voluntarily to meet their common needs through a jointly owned enterprise. And so they've identified some need that's not being met in the market economy. And so often that is the need for good jobs, better wages, or it might be the need for a particular kind of business that a for-profit business might not see the advantage or enough profit in creating a certain business, but the people in the community might want it. So there's almost always, in my experience, some sense of mission for people who are trying to create cooperatives. But again, they're two sides of the same coin.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think leads me to ask the gentleman in studio just about what they're doing. And so Larry Filipski is the chief financial officer of Once Again Nut Butter, which is an ESOP model. Is that right?
That's correct.
All right, ESOP stands for what, Larry?
Employee Stock Ownership Plan.
Okay, and so Once Again Nut Butter was founded when?
Once Again Nut Butter was started in the late 70s. By a husband and wife team who just decided they were going to start another business. They had experience starting others and came across saying, well, we're going to do this once again, and ended up with Once Again making nut butters. In 1998, it became an ESOP at 49%, while the owners had 51%. And in 2006, the owners sold their 51% share to the employees, and it became 100% employee-owned.
All right, so employee-owned, 100%, and how many employees at Once Again?
We're up to about 65 right now.
Okay. How does that function then in terms of decision-making, et cetera? Why don't you lay the landscape out for us?
Well, you have to remember a couple things. An ESOP is an employee stock ownership plan. It's an ownership structure, and it's really a retirement plan. And ESOPs can function in any way that you set them up. And there's ESOPs that are large. You know, you've heard of Gore-Tex. The Gore Company is an ESOP. Publix Supermarkets, that's another ESOP. So they're very large companies, and they operate just like any other company with the same type of a management structure with the tree and the branches and everything like any place has. And then you have some very small ESOPs that operate on a more democratic style of management. So the decision-making structure is something that can be set up any way you want. The ESOP is just that the employees own the company and get the benefits of the ownership. As the company gets bigger, it becomes more and more necessary to move towards a traditional management style, simply because it becomes too difficult when you've got 65, 70, 100 employees to sit in a room and try to make a decision. You can't get 100 people to agree on, you know, whether a dress is white and black or gold and black.
It was gold and blue, by the way. I can't even believe we were talking about that. I think that's interesting. And so, yeah, as Time Magazine kind of sketched out, the old cliche of what people think about co-ops, small company, sort of a, you know, probably an outdated understanding of what these kind of ideas are. But you've hit 65 employees, so you do have, your company looks in terms of management and decision making like what you would describe as a traditional company that we're used to?
It's moving in that direction. It started out much more on the co-op model. And as we've grown, we found the need that we've got to make some changes. And it's really in an evolution state right now. So we're a little bit of both and trying to determine which is going to be the best model for the company. You hate to give up the democratic, everybody has a say model. But we do make sure, no matter what, that everybody's voice is heard. So that it's participatory, even if the decision finally comes down to one lead manager.
Have you had pushback from employees who are frustrated with maybe less of a voice as the company grows?
You'll always get that sort of thing, but it's not a major pushback. It's just like, gee, I wish it was the way it used to be.
Yeah, a dozen people kind of all trying to agree.
Right, but everybody understands as the company grows that it's just not possible on some things. Some types of decisions, if you're changing an employee benefits policy or something like that, you can have a vote. You can go through the whole procedure that you normally would with any type of a co-op or the way the company would in the past. Those are things that you can do because you have a little bit of time. It's the decisions that need to be made very quickly because it is a business after all, and we are competing with companies that are traditional businesses, and sometimes you need to make a decision very, very quickly, and somebody has to make that decision, and you can't have 65 people hemming and hawing about it until you make it because then it's too late.
All right, Larry Lynn, let me get back to that question on mission or the question of why do it this way. Why does Once Again do it this way with an ESOP?
It does it this way mainly because that was the vision of the owners. But again, ESOPs will have all sorts of reasons. There are tax advantages to being an ESOP and to selling your company, if you own a company, to selling it to an ESOP. You can get tax advantages. So that's the way they kind of come into being. Our company has had a mission and a sustainability and a help the fair trade situation and all that kind of stuff. We've had that going for years and years. We work in Nicaragua with some of the suppliers for some of our raw materials. So the mission is kind of company specific, but in the case of Once Again Nut Butter, it is very, very oriented in the sustainability and the employee ownership model.
Jim DeLuca, the general manager of Abundance Cooperative Market. First of all, Jim, for our listeners who might not know, what is Abundance?
Abundance Cooperative Market is the only food co-op in Rochester, and it's been in business in one or two or three iterations since the late 1960s, and we're currently owned by 2,000 Rochesterians.
Okay, and where are you?
We're at 62 Marshall Street, right off Monroe Avenue.
You're owned by 2,000 Rochesterians, but you have how many employees?
We have 27 employees.
So what is the model at Abundance?
Abundance is a consumer co-op. Consumer co-op. So the consumers own the co-op. And in our structure, we also work with a policy governance model. And Michael Healy is our board advisor. And so what that means is there's the board of directors, which is elected from the owners and by the owners. And so you have to be an owner to be on the board. And then the board's sole responsibility for the operations of the business is to create these policies and pass them off to the general manager and have the general manager report back on a regular basis about, am I doing what you've asked or not? So our structure is a typical structure, general manager, department heads, staff. And with Larry, we also, we like input from everything, and we have quarterly meetings of all staff, and we talk about what's going on, but in the end, it's the decision, normal style of making a decision.
Okay. Why do it this way at Abundance?
Well, if you go back to the second wave of co-ops in the United States, which is when we were founded the first time, and actually Jeremy and Connie, who were founders of Once Again, were involved in the co-op startup in Abundance also. And we were kind of there's no real food anywhere. And so there was this mission to find whole, real food and have a community. And that's what the mission was, to have a store that belonged to us and sold the stuff that we couldn't get in the supermarket. And the mission was, in the classic sense of what Michael Healy said, we exist to serve the needs of our owners.
Okay, but it could have been created with a more traditional ownership structure, sort of a top-down, couldn't it?
I don't think that at that point in time this would have worked. I mean, it was really the 60s revolution, and the co-op back then was the center of the anti-war movement, and they had some counseling work, and they taught classes. They had the Communiversity at the co-op. It used to be up on the firehouse on Monroe Avenue from 74 to 99.
So retail co-op, employee-owned businesses, ESOP, you're seeing some of what is out there. And if you want to call the program with questions or comments, we'd love to have you. It's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Michael Healy, we look around the country, Cleveland, now Rochester, as we've been reporting in recent weeks here, looking at the co-op model as a way to try to bring, essentially build wealth in neighborhoods there currently is poverty, to create businesses, to create these kind of startups and ideas. What are you seeing around the country when it comes to this idea of the co-op model helping ameliorate poverty?
I think those examples are really wonderful examples of the idea of alleviating poverty and creating worker-owned businesses. So there are people living in a community who have skills, talents that, for whatever reason, that the owners of businesses aren't going in there and starting businesses. And so the people in those communities, with support, are able to create businesses that serve the community. And just the very fact of having a business there is one way to alleviate poverty, right? You've got an economic engine, you're generating profits, and in those cases, there are profits that are designed to stay in the community because it's a community-owned business. So that's one version of, I think, some very exciting stuff that's going on around the country. I'm not directly involved with that, but I pay attention to that. I read about that, and I think there's some really innovative ideas out there. So the Cleveland, the Evergreen model is being tested, tried out in different communities. Simultaneous with that is the wave, again, is what I spoke of, where I'm spending most of my energies, which is the consumer-owned food cooperatives. And there, the goal is less about alleviating poverty than like Jim described the abundance story. There's that wave of co-ops that were started in the late 60s, early 70s, which were really driven by people's desire for different organizational structures and access to good, healthy food, natural foods. Today, that is being layered with folks saying, huh, we've got a community here. It might be an urban community or a rural community where there is not a grocery store. The mom-and-pop grocery stores, those folks have retired, moved out. The bigger chains don't see a reason to come in. And so there are people starting stores, businesses in their community to serve needs. So that's less of a poverty alleviation than making sure we're meeting our economic needs for access to food.
Michael, when it comes to those outdated ideas on co-ops, or I don't know if this is outdated. I was having a conversation before the broadcast on the fact that the old idea was that some, at least in some co-ops, if not most, you have to be an owner to shop there. And as far as I know, that's largely gone away. But can you describe that?
Yeah, I think that is a perception that's out there, and I think that might have been true long ago. There are a couple I know of in terms of retail cooperatives, there might be a couple out there where that is the rule, where if you aren't a member, you don't shop there. Most of the food cooperatives operate much like any other grocery store would. You walk in there, you can do your shopping, you can get what you want, and you go back home and make a tasty lunch. If you happen to be an owner, then there are other benefits that might accrue, just like if you owned any other profitable business, but you don't have to be an owner to shop in a cooperative.
So when we look at Rochester now, as WXXI has been reporting, David Riley of the Democrat and Chronicle has been reporting extensively on the city's at least consideration of the co-op model as a way to try to fight poverty. As David reports, the lovely Warren's administration has been looking at Cleveland, been thinking about this, and we're still kind of waiting to find out where in the city, how you would target certain neighborhoods and what you would do with it. But as David reports, the co-ops would be designed to contract with major local institutions, such as hospitals and universities, to provide basic goods and services. And Cleveland, for example, home to a worker-owned laundry, a vegetable greenhouse, solar energy businesses. So there looks like there's a lot of different opportunities. But Jim DeLuca from Abundance Cooperative Market, if the city calls you, and maybe the city has called you, to say, hey, we just want to learn more about what's going on here, how do you communicate to them the possible advantages here? What kind of vision would you see for the city of Rochester as a way to use cooperatives to try to fight poverty?
Well, I think I was having a conversation with somebody the other day, and a lot of the problem with poverty is the fact that a lot of people just don't have any participation in the economy, and they just have nothing to lose. So they just hang around. There's nothing going on. There's a lot of drug dealing, whatever happens in these poverty neighborhoods. So it's in a limited or a different fashion, you want people to feel like they belong to something. Alienation causes lots of problems. So one of the things about a co-op has been all along, there's this feeling that this is my place. You know, it's a goal for lots of businesses to be that third place. Starbucks became a world famous third place, but co-ops have always been that as well. So I would say that one of the advantages of having a kind of a retail, even a worker co-op in a poverty neighborhood, would be that addressing of the alienation aspect of poverty. And I know when I was living in Atlanta, there was this whole mindset. This was back in the 80s and 70s, that if you had a nice chair that you had on your porch, but it wasn't chained down, it was not expected. You didn't care about it. It wasn't, you know, if you wanted it, you'd have it fixed so it wouldn't be taken away. So there's that sense of, if you don't have anything to lose, what are you going to do? So I think co-ops really partly address that issue of breaking down alienation.
27 employees at Abundance. How many of those employees are from pretty close by?
I would say 22.
22.
Could walk.
Do you have 22 could walk?
Probably, yeah.
Do you have rules on where the employee should come from?
We don't.
You don't.
But we only have two employees who live out of town.
Okay. What about, once again, Nutbutter, Larry, in terms of 65 employees, how many are pretty close by?
Well, Nunde is a little bit...
a little different than Rochester, I know.
It's a little bit in the middle of nowhere, so close by is defined a little bit differently.
Yeah, I understand.
But of the 65, I would say that the majority of them live within 15 miles of the plant, which in Nunde is very close. I myself live in Pittsford and drive 50 miles, but I'm the rare one. There's a handful of us that drive much more than about 15 miles to get in there.
And Michael Healy, again, from CDS Consulting Co-op, who's on the line with us. Is there a misperception that co-ops by nature have to stay small? Again, Larry's been talking about the growth of, once again, Nutbetter. You want successful enterprises to grow, and we opened the program looking at the Basque region of Spain. Mondragon, for example, is certainly not small, but is there a misperception that they have to be small, or do they function more effectively when they are smaller?
I think that, again, this depends on the kind of business you're in. So cooperatives can be many things. So credit unions are a form of cooperative, and there are some really large credit unions around the country. With millions and millions of dollars of assets and tens of thousands of members. In my own hometown of Burlington, Vermont, I'm a member of a food cooperative which has over 10,000 members, a couple hundred employees, and there are other co-ops around the country that are food co-ops that are even larger than that. So I don't think size is a driving factor. For some people, it might be in their own cooperative. They might decide that size is really a driving force. But I think co-ops can be as big or small as any other kind of business. So by being a cooperative doesn't dictate the size of the business.
All right, I'm going to get a break in here, and we're going to come back to your phone calls. It's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Some comments starting to come in via email, edawson@wxxi.org, via Twitter @EvanDawson, and the phones are ringing. So your comments and questions about cooperatives and this model, as Rochester looks at the cooperative model in our own community as a way of alleviating poverty, that's next on Member-Supported Public Radio. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, and our panel for the hour discussing cooperatives on the line, Michael Healy from CDS Consulting Co-op, Larry Filipski, the Chief Financial Officer of Once Again Nutbutter down in Nunde, and Jim DeLuca is the General Manager of Abundance Cooperative Market. Our first caller is Bonnie. Go ahead, Bonnie. Thanks for calling.
Yes, hi. I wanted just to kind of make a little bit of a statement regarding maybe what's going on here locally. First of all, there have been some people here locally who've been interested in these kind of in different co-ops, primarily the employee-owned, I think, would be the emphasis, for going back a ways. And, in fact, a number of people, primarily folks from the Green Party, were running as candidates using advocating for this approach. I think, too, that something that was said earlier, the importance of, obviously, this is about jobs, too, and people have to earn a living, very, very important. The other parts of it, though, is that poverty often has these kind of, very uncomfortable negative effects of people kind of feeling out of touch with their community. The thing that a lot of people like about this approach is that having that sense of community come at least be strengthened and come back is very, very important. The other thing is that right now what we've been trying to do, some of us have been getting together with people in the Northeast, and we're planning on doing some other get-togethers with people out throughout the city. And we've been showing the film Shift Change, and people have been showing interest. And the reason all that's important, besides the obvious knowledge gain, but also important because for this to be successful, a lot of us feel it has to really come from the roots of people in the neighborhoods. And unfortunately, a lot of people do not know about co-ops. So there's been some leadership, collective leadership in areas to inform people by the folks that I was just naming. And that's really a critical piece. So I'm actually hoping, I know one of the people who is going to be in charge of these co-ops is new staff. I don't know if they've started yet for the city. What I would like to see, I would love to see WXXI have that person back and some people from the community who are interested in these to have some public media dialogue on that detail so that they have their voices and they much very much need that. Thank you.
Thank you, Bonnie. And certainly I think it's a very good idea. And it is something that we will pursue for sure. As just as a recent example, Rochester's economic development and director of neighborhood development, Del Smith, left, and there is a new person in that role. And so certainly, yeah, we will be following up with that and look to bring in people around Rochester as perhaps these plans develop. But Bonnie is talking about what we could see in Rochester in terms of more of a cooperative approach, a cooperative model for these enterprises. And Michael Healy Alex writes to us, on average, are wages in co-ops better? I don't know the answer to that. Do you?
Oh, I don't know that I have a definitive answer.
Okay.
Because I think many co-ops do have some mission aspect to their work. They probably tend to try to have higher wages, but like any other business, they have to work within a competitive marketplace. And so you can't just have high wages if you don't also have a business that's generating the income to pay for that. So I think it probably depends from co-op to co-op.
Yeah, Larry and Jim, how do you do in terms of wages?
Well, once again, nut butter is competitive and on wages and way above the mark on benefits. So the company really, really does take care of its employees. There are, last I looked, about 10,000 ESOPs in the country serving about 10 million employees. And most of those employees do a little bit better than the average in their area. Again, like Michael said, you can't go way over because if you go way over the averages, then you become uncompetitive and the business model just doesn't work. But the ESOPs do tend to have much better wages and benefits in general than the average company.
Jim?
At Abundance, we've had a living wage initiative for several years. We have been paying more than minimum wage for many years. And we're a very small company. We sell less than $3 million a year. And anybody who is a full-time person does get a living wage.
Okay. And Rich writes to the program with a different tack. Rich says, hold on, let me get back to Rich's comment, says, this model sounds a lot to me like socialism, he says. Okay, I'm sure we've heard that before. You're smiling already, Jim. You want to tackle that one?
Sure. I'll say a little history. The co-op movement in America started in the Depression, 1930s, and became very strong. And after the war, after World War II, when the Red Scare came about, all the co-ops, which had developed a lot of fully integrated vertical businesses, they got smeared with the communist banner. And so the co-ops, there were lots of large co-ops in America that came up during the Depression, and they all got wiped out. So when Michael Healy mentioned the 60s and 70s, that was the second wave of co-ops. So the other ones were started. And so it's much more democratic, actually, because the leadership of our co-op gets elected by the people who own the store. There's nothing socialist about it.
I guess that if you believe that this model is socialism, then any sort of company that provides any sort of stock, any company that puts out an IPO, I guess, is turning to socialism. Michael Healy, am I wrong in thinking that that it's hard to think of this as socialism just because employees may own a part of it?
I would say that the socialism label, just I don't feel like it's relevant in this conversation. So what you have are democratic organizations, which is not the same as socialist organizations. So yes, in cooperatives, right, ESOPs are slightly different in how they're organized, but in cooperatives, it's a democracy, one person, one vote. But they are businesses, right? So they're just, you walk into a credit union and you don't think, oh, this is a socialist institution. You think, this is a banking institution where I might be able to have a checking account. And that it's any of these co-ops, they are democratically controlled, but they're businesses that serve a need in their community.
Okay. Well, if you want to get back on the program and join us on the conversation here, it's 844-295-TALK, 844-295 or 263-844-295-8255. Boy, oh boy, how many times have you said the number and you lose it in your brain? 263-WXXI if you're right here in Rochester, 263-9994. Jim DeLuca from Abundance wanted to bring in a little history as well.
Sure.
And you mentioned Frederick Douglass.
Well, you started out the whole talk by saying the Industrial Revolution in Europe created this drive.
Or really pushed it forward.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And what happened back then in the 1840s, there was a lot of problems in England and because the Industrial Revolution was pushing people off the farms. And so in 1844, after the failure of the Chartist movement in England, millions of people tried to get the vote, and Parliament refused to give them the vote. And so the co-op movement started after the failure of the Chartist movement. And in 1844, 28 families started the Rochdale Pioneers Retail Food Co-op, which is now considered the founding of a retail food business. And when Frederick Douglass was in exile in England in 1846, and he toured, he gave three talks in Rochdale, England in 1846, November 10th and November 11th. And so maybe it's a coincidence that it's Rochdale and Rochester. I don't know.
You ever heard that before, Larry?
I've never heard that story before, but I'm glad I heard it now.
Brian writes to us, we've seen wages stagnate in this country even as employment has crept back up. Can your panel talk about the impact on wages? Again, I think there have been a number of comments or questions about wages. We just hit that, Brian, but real briefly here, again, I think that there's no there's no one-size-fits-all description of wages in a cooperative or an ESOP, et cetera. But as Larry and Jim have described, they try to be very competitive, and I certainly think at least it is something that the people in this kind of a movement are thinking about when it comes to wages. Jim, is that fair?
Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, Larry, I mean, again, you're just one company, but stagnant wages. Yeah, I mean, I think it's fair to wonder, for the most part, why this economy has been ostensibly bouncing back without wages.
That is interesting, and you can talk to all the economists about that. I have no idea why that would be the case, but the ESOPs that I'm familiar with, once again included, have had a history of continuously increasing wages, maybe not as high as people would like them, but the inflation rate hasn't been very high either. So a 2% or a 2.5% wage increase annually for the last 5 years would definitely translate to better than inflation. So the ESOPs that I'm familiar with all really make an effort to maintain a decent wage and a decent level of wage increases. Frankly, you wouldn't be able to get employees if you didn't. You still need to hire your employees. You still need to compete with everybody else that's out there.
Michael Healy, Bill wants to know what kinds of companies lend themselves to co-ops. And you briefly touched on, you typically work in food co-ops, Michael?
Well, my work primarily is in that arena. But for example, my CDS consulting co-op, here the name, is a cooperative, and it's a different kind of cooperative. So I, as a consultant, am an independent contractor and have joined with a couple dozen other independent contractors to form a cooperative, a shared services cooperative. So our co-op, I'm not an employee of the cooperative, but it provides services to me and my fellow consultants. Ace Hardware is a form of a cooperative, right? So it's owned by the individual retailers. Individual retailers own the hardware store, and together they own the Ace Hardware brand and distribution centers. Electric co-ops in certain parts of the country, electric co-ops are a big provider of power for people in that region. There are healthcare co-ops. There are, as I said, credit unions. There are a whole range of different retail cooperatives. Food cooperatives are probably the most familiar, credit unions also. Agricultural cooperatives, really common, very powerful way for farmers, producers to join forces and market their goods and to buy the services and products that they need together. So a whole range of kinds of cooperatives around the country and around the world.
And Michael Mark writes to us and wants to know if the Green Bay Packers are a cooperative.
Well, they're definitely, they're put out as an example of community ownership. So I don't believe that their legal structure is strictly a cooperative, but they are really held out as an example of community ownership. So they're owned by many, many people in the Green Bay community.
Isn't it interesting, Michael, that every time we heard the Buffalo Bills ownership question come up in recent years before the Pegulas bought them, people in Western New York said, can't we be the next Green Bay Packers? And I think there were some legal structures that prevented that. But it certainly is popular to the fans. The people seem to like the idea.
Well, I think that there might be a lot of reasons to like it, but one of the things that happens if your business is owned by the community, it's unlikely that the owner of that business is going to sell the business to someone else in another community. Right? So it's one way to, and back to the evergreen model and what you all are talking about there in Rochester, one of the advantages of rooting a business in cooperative ownership is that it also roots it in the community. And so it's very unlikely that a cooperatively owned business is going to be sold to some out-of-state owner who will then move the business somewhere else. And I think that's one of the advantages that people see in the Green Bay model, is that team has never been sold to some other owner in another city.
Larry Filipski from, once again, Nut Butter, can you imagine, it's an ESOP in your company, can you imagine it being anywhere but Nunde?
There is no place else it could be at this point in time at all. I mean, it's just a phenomenal thing to be in. And we're actually expanding in Nunde. And building an expansion plant could be done anywhere, but we're doing it in Nunde.
Jim DeLuca, Abundance Cooperative Market. It's got one home, doesn't it?
It does have one home, and we are looking for a bigger one.
Okay, but are you...
In town.
In town.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and that kind of goes back to the initial point there. All right, back to the phones. Brian in Rochester. Brian, go ahead.
Well, hi. On your, a few minutes ago, somebody made the comment about, isn't this socialism?
Yeah.
Socialism means the ownership by the government.
Right.
And the incentives are all wrong. It seems to me here, the incentives are right, that there's a reason for productivity and service and everything being right. It's completely different than socialism. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about the incentives for the players to make this thing work properly.
Thank you, Brian. Yeah, he was responding to Rich's comment when Rich wrote in and said, isn't this just socialism? Brian's saying, no, not only is it not owned by the government, but when the employees are involved or in an ESOP or they're owning shares or if the workers are owning the business, that there's more incentive. So again, these models are all slightly different. Abundance is a retail cooperative, so the employees don't own it. But at the same time, Jim, I think you can at least weigh in with whether you think there is an incentive based on the cooperative model to be productive.
Well, employees can be owners as well. They can buy a share for $100 like anybody else. And in that case, they have the same privileges to vote for the board and reap the benefits. The incentive in terms of why you would want to, we've had profit sharing for all the years we've had profit. We attract people who feel a sense of community, and so there's a reward at the work site itself for that sense. And I believe I just talked to some people yesterday about. So I ask my staff all the time, you know, what's going on with you, and we try to create this community feel, which is what the where we've came from.
Well, what about you, Larry? What do you think about his comment about just the impact on productivity?
ESOPs and I assume co-ops definitely improve productivity. That's been tested and proven throughout the country on all the ESOP models. And I can tell you anecdotally all kinds of stories about things that people do because they are a part owner that they would not do as an employee. The types of people that tend to work and remain in these types of businesses are the ones who are not first and foremost interested in advancing their own career to the detriment of everybody else. Those types of people don't thrive in a place like an ESOP or a co-op because they're just too self-centered, frankly, and they want to make sure that their own career gets better. That's not what happens in ESOPs and co-ops.
Michael Healy?
Well, I don't want to disparage private ownership or equity stock ownership.
Sure.
Those are really valuable, but what co-ops can offer is that if I'm a consumer owner, I recognize the symbiotic relationship between the business I own and my behavior. So that if I am shopping at the co-op and the co-op is serving my needs and then my co-op is profitable, I get a share of the profits as an owner of that business. A worker in a worker-owned co-op, if they are productive and the business is profitable, not only are they getting their wages, but they get a share of the profits of the business. As opposed to an outside owner or a separate owner taking those profits, I might not be as motivated to work on behalf of someone else, but if it's my business, whether I'm a consumer or a worker, I might be much more highly motivated to help the business be successful and profitable.
I'm going to try to work through as many other comments as we've been getting as we can here. I also wanted to ask just about something that I read in preparing for this hour. Again, I went back to that story in Time magazine looking at Spain, and they said one hallmark of that Spanish model is its use of capital. Rather than flowing into the pockets of executives and outside investors, a company's profits are distributed in a precise democratic way, set aside as seed money for new cooperatives, distributed to regional nonprofits, or pooled into shared institutions like a university and research center. In other words, each individual cooperative gains long-term benefits from the financial assets of the whole. Again, sometimes when you look at models, Spain to Cleveland to Rochester to the UK, sometimes it's apples and oranges. But Michael Healy, what Time magazine is describing is an interesting way to look at the flow of capital. What do you make of that?
Well, it's hard for us to exactly compare what's happening in Rochester or in my town with Mondragon, which is a long-established, really large and highly functional cooperative system. But even on a small scale, the owners of a small cooperative, whether it's Abundance in Rochester or anywhere else, those owners can determine what happens to the profits of the business, which of those profits are going to be cycled back into the business to help the business grow, and which are going to be distributed to the owners in terms of profit sharing, patronage dividends at the end of a year. So hopefully the owners are not trying to suck the profits out of the business and leave the business stagnant. They're trying to circle that money back into the co-op and grow the co-op.
Yeah, Sharon writes, a lot of talk about employee wages this hour, but not as much talk about what executives make. She goes on to write about the fact that she thinks in some cases what executives and CEOs make is, in her words, appalling, and she thinks that this model sounds fairer. Again, Michael, that's a generalized comment, but I suspect you've heard that before.
Sure. Again, I can't speak to what happens in every co-op sector, but what I've observed is that the wage distribution in the co-ops that I work with feels much fairer to people. So managers, CEOs are getting paid well for the work that they're doing, but that's not out of line with what everyone else in the cooperative is getting paid. And I think that's again, there's just these are community-based businesses where people are neighbors with each other. They're owning something together. And so I think they're just much more likely to treat each other fairly in that process.
Jim, you agree?
Essential.
Yep.
Yes, we're really clear at Abundance, and we have the Mondragon standard used to be 6-to-8-to-1 as a good example, and we're way below that at Abundance.
Okay, Larry.
I can say as a senior manager that unequivocally the senior management at the ESOP company at Once Again Nut Butter does not make obscene amounts of money. And there actually is a factor built right into the company bylaws that limits the amount that can be paid to a factor above the lowest paid employee.
And I think, by the way, that I want to be careful not to denigrate the idea of people making a lot of money. I just think, again, part of Sharon's comment lines up with the idea that in some cases, maybe a small amount of American companies, but at least enough that are large companies that look egregious. When you see a CEO making 300 or 400 times what an employee makes, I'm not making a value judgment. I'm saying that I have heard from plenty of listeners who do find that troubling. And I guess what Larry is saying, what Jim is saying, is you're not going to see that in an ESOP like Nunday. You certainly wouldn't see that at Abundance. Fair enough?
Fair enough. Correct.
Okay. Before I get back to the phone, Scott on Twitter, and let me get Scott's comment here as I pull it back up. I saw it written earlier. Scott says, can you ask your guests if there are any sharing economy entities that are co-op or ESOP organizations? I don't know. I actually confess, Scott, I don't know exactly what that means. Michael Healy, I don't know what his question means.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure I understand it either. So the sharing economy, what I understand of that is really just what it describes. So the ESOPs and the cooperatives that we're talking about, they're an ownership structure. They're businesses that are owned in certain ways, which may or may not fit into what Scott was talking about in terms of sharing economy.
Okay. Jim, does that make sense to you? Have you heard the term before?
I'm interpreting it like local fund capitalism, like Ithaca Dollars, Ithaca Hours, where you invest and there's no real money exchanged. I've worked with one in Greenfield, Massachusetts, trying to get one started in that sense, so it is kind of a sharing economy. That's what I think. In the end, it might work, but it requires a lot of effort to find. When I was managing the co-op in Greenfield, they wanted us to participate, but then I have to spend a way to spend those dollars. So when people come in with their local money and I can't spend it at my providers, then I can't do it. So I spent a lot of time trying to find places where I could spend the local dollars, and I couldn't.
Vic writes to the program, and he says, indeed, all cooperatives are not small. There's REI, Recreational Equipment Incorporated, with headquarters in Washington State, millions of members and stores across the country. Michael, are you familiar with that?
Oh, yes. REI is again, one of those giant versions of a consumer-owned cooperative, very successful.
Okay. So I think what we're hearing from our listeners is just number one, I think we've tried to cover a lot of ground answering the questions of what is a cooperative, what is a worker-owned business, what is an ESOP, which again, Larry, stands for?
Employee Stock Ownership Plan.
Okay. What is a retail cooperative? But a lot of them have sort of a, broadly speaking, similar missions, and I think that the city of Rochester may try to pursue at least some of these models to try to bring wealth to neighborhoods that currently have poverty. And so let me try to get some closing thoughts from the panel. Jim, I know Abundance seems to be doing well. Mm-hmm. What do you want to leave our listeners with as we think about cooperatives, as we think about our community?
Well, I think the biggest issue is that we are a direct community. We're trying to be the third place. We think that we see people as individuals, and that part of our responsibility at Abundance is to help make people feel welcome, break down alienation. Life is really fast and busy and distracted, and so I work with my employees all the time to have them see the people who come in the door as people and not as shoppers.
Okay. Larry?
Well, you know, the word co-op obviously is short for cooperation. I think it's short for cooperative, but I'm going to use cooperation here in my comment. I think that society today has kind of lost that level of cooperation that used to exist many just in general with people years and years and years ago. And everybody seems to be out for themselves. If the society would embrace the cooperation model and put co-ops into place, I think that a lot of the poverty could be alleviated. Now, you're not going to turn all those people into multimillionaires, but you will pay them a living wage and you will make them much less of a blight on the community simply because the area happens to be that way. The cooperation is what is the big thing in my mind.
And Michael Healy, what do you think?
Well, you know, if the economy is weak or troubled, we can do a few things. We could wait for some business owner, some rich person to come in and start a business and make things happen. And if that works, great. And if that doesn't work, well, maybe we can wait for our government to come in and provide support or handouts And if that works, great. But if that doesn't work, well, maybe we could cooperate. Maybe we could become active participants in our own economic destiny and join forces and work together to meet our common needs. And cooperatives are a really wonderful way to do that.
Michael Healy, CDS Consulting Co-op, thanks for taking the time to join the program this hour.
It's been very fun.
And Larry Filipski from, once again, Nut Butter. We find your products all over the place, I think. I've seen them in Wegmans, yes?
You have seen them in Wegmans. They are in Whole Foods, and they are in many other stores, including Abundance Markets.
Yeah, and let's be fair to the man from Abundance who's sitting here. Jim, I'm going to say Abundance first in front of Wegmans every time I think about, once again, Nut Butter in the future, because you sell them there. And for people who have not been out to Abundance, where are you?
62 Marshall Street, right off Monroe Avenue.
Okay. And thriving and growing, it sounds like.
Absolutely.
Thank you for taking the time, Jim. Larry, thank you as well. Great talking to you. And let's continue the conversation as we see what the city of Rochester decides to do when it comes to the co-op model here. Short break, and we're talking about Indiana's new law. Some breaking news today about their changes to that law. And we're talking about how Rochester and the state of New York reacted to that law. Join the conversation in just a few moments.